Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is Chief Surgeon Ange. Hi, Ange. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks so much for inviting me. I'm having my orange juice and Oreos after donating blood. So hopefully I'll be able to...
It's a terrible taste profile to combine them, but yeah. yeah, we're going to talk about that in this episode. Of course, this is episode 23 of season 5, the penultimate episode of season 5, Post-Op. The original air date was March 8th, 1977, written by Ken Levine and David Isaacs, Gene Reynolds and Jay Fulb, and directed by Gene Reynolds. So let's get right to it. The 477th is low on blood, so low that they have to call around to other units to see if they can scrounge up some more. Colonel Potter begs and pleads, and Hawkeye demands, to little avail. Things are made even worse when more wounded arrive. This leads to a tension-filled session in OR, with Hawkeye and BJ threatening to break Frank's legs when he complains about the working conditions. Potter tells them all to clam up. In post-op, various cases are tended to. Margaret helps a soldier write a letter home. Klinger helps console a Puerto Rican soldier who was upset that the doctors had to shave his impressive mustache to patch up his face. BJ comforts a soldier who lost his leg due to a landmine. And Hawkeye gives advice to a soldier embarrassed by getting wounded in his rear end. Frank is worried about his patient, who is still unconscious, and he can't figure out why. He asks Colonel Potter for help, but is really looking more to just find someone to blame. After he learns that the soldier was found in his sleeping bag, unconscious, it dawns on Potter that perhaps a snake crawled in there with him and bit the soldier, knocking him out. He orders Nurse Kelly to give the young man a shot of anti-venom. One of BJ's patients is a soldier who's actually upset that he's being shipped home. He has such a great series of black market businesses going on in South Korea, he actually tries to bribe BJ into letting him stay. Of course, it doesn't work. Klinger helps the despondent soldier by giving him a custom-made mustache, which he gratefully accepts. Margaret rebuffs the advances of another soldier who, even though he's married, pledges his eternal love. The blood supply gets so low that Colonel Potter asks everyone in the camp to donate, even though it's been less than 48 hours since everyone donated the last time. Only Frank has managed not to donate at all, but he's dragged into it by Hawkeye and BJ. The blood supply problem finally ends when a truck full of Turkish soldiers arrive, ready to donate. Thankful to the 477 for taking care of one of their wounded, they are here each to donate blood. They file into the mess tent to the applause of everyone in the compound, just as Frank bursts out, chased by a needle-carrying Klinger. All right, Ange, the first thing I want to ask you specifically, because you know this stuff, is the idea of a post-op, right? Now, I know that in the 477th, they have to have all the soldiers together because space is at a premium. They don't have, you know, space. But has that been something that's changed over time? That people now kind of get their own recovery rooms. Was there ever a generalized recovery room where just everybody was in there together in hospitals for the most part?
Yeah, what I can say is that there is the immediate area after surgery, which is called the PACU, which is post-anesthesia care unit. Those are more like one big unit. There are like half walls and curtains, but almost everybody is brought in there to recover. So there are group rooms like that. There used to be indeed things like we used to call them wards for inpatients, right? Like for somebody that has to truly recover, right? In those PACU areas, it could be that you had day surgery, you wake up and you leave. For people that have to stay in hospitals long-term, there used to be wards, one giant room with just beds. Think about if you watched The Nick or something like that, they would walk bed to bed and round. Wow. And now there were rooms in hospitals. But I can tell you, even in my career, things like the neonatal intensive care unit was just one big open room with a bunch of, you know, isolettes and cribs, and there were other like asthma rooms where there would just be four beds and one giant room. So This is still, you know, the concept of an immediate area where like everybody is sort of visible for a small crew to sort of round on a bunch of people is still around. If you're there for any long-term period of time, almost every hospital has just single rooms now for privacy reasons.
Gotcha. Okay. Because, I mean, I have to say, when I think of the other great example of recovery rooms in fiction, it's the final scene, and it's a mad world where everybody is in their casts, and they're all just in one room, because of course that's the comedies, that you have everybody together, so you could do the pratfall with Ethel Merman and stuff. But I always wondered, is that a real thing? Did they really do that to everybody? But okay, so now we know that that's kind of changed over time. And you say it was mostly for privacy, not necessarily medical reasons. It was just to give patients more privacy.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're staying there for a long period of time, right, not like I'm recovering from my anesthesia and I'm leaving, that it's for privacy, and probably the same thing. You don't want to, if you don't have something infectious, you don't want to be 4 feet away from somebody that is infected, right? So you try to give everybody single rooms nowadays so that, you know, it's both for the staff's protection and the patient's protection, given that there are sick people in the hospital. But the same thing, right? You don't want to be next to somebody and then 5 feet away they're saying, like, how's your gonorrhea, right? Like, you want to maintain some decorum and things like that.
That's, I wouldn't want to hear that necessarily if I was in the hospital. So I can remember the only time I've ever had surgery last year, when I got my hernia done, and I was in, there was a patient in the next, you know, bed over. We were separated by a curtain. But, I mean, he was having wild conversations with his nurse, and I heard every word of it, because there was only that little thin piece of film separating the two of us. And it was like, I was like, all right, dude, I'm kind of really getting a full glimpse of his whole life just for the fact, because we were all in one big room together. So, okay. All right. Good to know. I'm a little smarter now than I was when I got up this morning, which is always good. So this episode, as I mentioned, the title is called Post-Op, which makes it, you know, kind of one of their bottle episodes. There is the opening scene in Potter's office where he's trying to round up some blood. And then there's a scene in the operating room. But for the most part, it's all just post-op. And it kind of makes me think about, like, you know, obviously season three, they had the OR episode, which was all in the OR. And I got to wonder, like, if the show had gotten into, like, season 15, would they have been, like, the scrub room, the supply shed, the VIP tent, like running out of the barber tent. You know, they're running out of ideas of, you know, bottle episodes to do. But it makes total sense to just kind of do like a round robin of cases. And this episode, as we'll see, features more guest actors than almost any other episode of MASH I can think of. There's something like 8 guest actors, all of which I had to kind of look up and figure out their credits, which wasn't easy because some of these people don't have pictures on their IMDb profile. So I had to kind of, this guy was Robolo, this guy was Corden, which guy was this guy? But hopefully I got it all right, and we'll get to it. But the opening scene, as I said, is in Potter's office where he is rounding up some blood. And kind of much like the episode previous to this, Souvenirs, or even your favorite, Ange, Adam's Rib, where those are dealing with problems so specific to being in a medical unit far from kind of modern conveniences, that makes it a MASH specific kind of problem. And of course, that's what's going on here, is that, you know, the 477th is out of blood, and that's a big deal. Now, what could be done? Now, obviously this gets solved by the Turkish soldiers who arrive at the end, which I mentioned, but what could be done if, like, a hospital runs out of blood? I mean, what do you do? Anything?
Yeah, I mean, I will tell you that probably every third day or so, over the overhead of the hospital that I work at, they're like, our patients are in dire need of blood. Please come to the blood donating, right? So they're doing all of the things that even today we do, right? Let's round up our staff and see if they can give. You know, let's ask other hospitals nearby, do you have extra that you can give? I would assume that, you know, they're close enough to Tokyo that, you know, pack a whole bunch of blood and ice, fly it here as quickly as you possibly can, would be something else that they could try to do. But otherwise, you just think very, very judiciously about how much blood are you going to use, and, you know, what are your parameters for using it? It's not plentiful, right? Like, I think of even later on, there's an episode where they run out of morphine, right? So who do we give morphine to, right? And how dire is the situation? Which leads me to a point that I'll come to later when we talk about the patients that do get blood in this episode.
Okay. So I love the good Potter is begging various people for blood, and then Hawkeye comes in and threatens it, which leads to the guy on the phone hanging up. And so Hawkeye is absolutely no help whatsoever. And I kind of love Potter's resigned, you know, well done, Pierce. He hung up. You know, it's like he just kind of ruined it. Thanks, Hawkeye. If I was Potter, maybe I'd get a little madder at Hawkeye for that. But okay, he's dealt with Hawkeye long enough at this point. He kind of knows that that's just the way Hawkeye's going to be. So then more wounded arrive, and we get on the bus, the ambulance, and we have the first of our number of guest stars. First is Hilly Hicks, the actor. Here he's playing a medic named Moody. This was his second appearance on MASH. He played a different character in the season 3 episode White Gold. He's the guy who's stealing the morphine that runs afoul of Colonel Flagg and leads that whole thing. So he was also on the show Rollout, which was not a MASH spinoff, but sort of a MASH side project by Gene Reynolds about an army unit in World War II, which only lasted, I think, about a season. But so, as I said, obviously, Hilly Hicks was on everybody's mind and on the creators of MASH, because here he comes back and he gets to play a different part. So then we go to a scene in OR, and we see that, as I mentioned, because of the low blood, everything is super tense. Everybody is really pissed off. And I love that tensions flare to the point where, as I mentioned, Hawkeye and BJ threaten Frank. And then Potter gets so mad at all of them that he just says, basically, quiet down all of you. He's like, I got a bullet near the heart. I don't need this hubbub. And then Margaret does this very loud shh sound effect. And Potter just gives her this look of like, you're not helping at all.
Can I go back to the bus scene for a second?
Oh, sure, of course.
So, first of all, do you think that he's playing the same character? I know their names are different, but I actually went back and watched that White Gold episode, and the name that he gives them in that at the beginning is like a false name. They're right, like the dog tags he gave. And then Hawkeye even says to him, hey, you were here about 6 months ago. You wanted to stuff me in a duffel bag.
Yep.
And there is some heated moments in that White Gold, so I was like, yeah, I wonder if he's playing the same Corman. So that was just one thing I was thinking. But the thing that really struck me about that is, if you look at the patients on that bus, their bandages are soaked in blood. And and I wonder if that was just a way to, like, almost foreshadow, they're going to run out of blood again. They're already low on blood, and here are these guys just drenched. It's more – the bloody bandages are more dramatic in that bus than I've seen in many MASH episodes. So I wasn't sure if that was an artistic choice or not.
Huh. I didn't even really notice. I didn't really think about it. Regarding Hilly Hicks's character, if you want to no prize it, you could absolutely say that he's playing the same character, because as you mentioned, Hawkeye talks about that they've met before, and he says, you know, yeah, you wanted to stuff me in my duffel bag. And yeah, as you mentioned, the White Gold, they do have a little bit. So yeah, MASH never bothered to play, you know, tight with continuity, but it absolutely could be. If you want to, and I like that. And timeline wise, you could even say 6 months. That's probably about right.
Yeah,
the way MASH has to do compressed timelines, you could see that
exactly.
Yeah. So again, they go back to surgery, and Margaret comes in and says, "We only have 10 units left." And Potter's like, "Thank God, we're almost done." Now, again, this is a very broad question, so I apologize if you really can't answer it because it's so vague. But like, I have no frame of reference for how much that is. It doesn't sound like very much, 10 units, but like, how many units is like a operation of one of these soldiers going to take, if you can even answer that? Is there, I mean, is it like the average is going to take 5 units, 2 units? Like, how many surgeries could 10 units possibly cover?
Yeah. So think about it like this. The volume in one human body is about 5 liters, which is about 10 units.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so if somebody is bleeding profusely, right, like you might have to use all 10 units, right? This guy has like lost half of his blood volume on the field before he even got to us. And now we're trying to sew up all of these wounds that are bleeding, and we're going to have to, we're going to have to be prepared to give a lot of blood. So it's not much, especially if you're talking about the grievous wounds that you could see in war, right? Of course, they were nearing the end of this 18-hour OR marathon. Like, how they're still standing, I have no idea. Hopefully they each got like 45 minutes somewhere to sort of like try to take a quick nap and shifts.
Right.
But I can tell you that for many surgeries, people will say, let's just have 2 units ready just in case, right? So they've got like, cross the sky for 2 units so that if we need them, you know, we'll be prepared to do it. So 10 units is not a lot.
Okay, right. Especially when you're dealing with the, you know, shrapnel wounds and people probably with missing limbs and
yes,
entire exactly. organs that are gone. In fact, there's another medical comment that I'm going to ask you about later, which is always sort of confused me. But later on, so we're in post-op, and we talk about they mentioned again that Potter's been told just to wait to get more blood, and then Hawkeye points out to Frank that he has not donated any blood at all, and he says this is strategy. One of us should always have a full tank, which is just that's just gibberish. We know that Frank's just a jerk. It is kind of amazing that Potter has allowed that. I mean, he could order Frank to do it. I mean, if everybody is donating multiple times and Frank hasn't donated at all, that's ridiculous. So I'm a little shocked that Potter has even let that go by because, you know, come on, Burns. You got to donate, yeah. man.
I can only imagine that it's one of those things that Frank keeps saying, like, I'll get to it, I'll get to right. it, and never gets to it. And then it's now the next round, right? Like, oh, I missed that round of donations. I never got a chance to get to it. So,
yeah.
but you're right. It's ridiculous.
a full tank.
Yeah. Doesn't like, work that way, really.
It's not like when you give blood, you are now one pint of blood less than you were. Like you know, it comes back, you know,
yes.
I mean, it's not like, you know,
you're
more. Empty. I mean, because if that was the case, I would be dead. I've given enough blood that I would be dead at this point. So yeah, it's like Burns again, just the most worst doctor in the world. So, Margaret is tending to one of the wounded. This patient is named Corey. It's played by Daniel Zippy. He had some TV credits like The Paper Chase, Murder, She Wrote, and The Waltons. And he gets Margaret to write a letter home. And there's this little bit where he talks about that he discovered one of the leaflets that the North Koreans leave behind. And it says one of those communist leaflets, the ones that say we're all fighting for Wall Street. And she says, personally, I refuse to read them. And, you know, not being super judgy, but that's a little insight into Margaret's personality. Because she is just, you know, there's that line of thinking is not going to gain any purchase with her at all, obviously. While, you know, it obviously reading communist propaganda is not super helpful. It's also, you know, I mean, there might be something to consider of why we're there. Why am I fighting? And in fact, I think by the performance of this actor, this character has some indication that maybe he's got a little bit of doubt as to why he's here. By the fact that he even mentioned, and then of course he tells a story about being face to face with a Chinese soldier, and they shot at each other, and he got wounded, but he killed his opponent. And Margaret, being Margaret, says, "Good for you." And the kid, this actor Daniel Zippy, goes, "I guess so." And you know, they don't. This is only this one scene for this actor, but he gets a lot to do. I love his read on that, where he just says, "I guess so," where he's not super happy. I mean, he did his job, but he's not really all that thrilled with the idea that he has killed somebody.
Yeah, I think you're so right that, you know, it's five or six lines, but there's a lot said. He says, this Chinese soldier looked about as young as me, right? So yeah. They're both kids. He said, yeah. We both stared at each other for a second, right? So this easily could have been that the Chinese soldier just runs away, right? But instead, this gunfight happens, and the Margaret stuff is fascinating with her responses, because he says, like, all of a sudden I looked up, there was a Chinese soldier, and her question to him is, how could you let him sneak up on you like
yeah,
that, right?
Yeah.
You know, because she's hardcore, she's raised military, right? And here's this kid who's probably not there by choice, right, who is, you know, in a foxhole reading a pamphlet, probably doesn't want to be there. So I agree, this is, you know, there's a whole bunch of these vignettes. This one in particular, I thought was fantastic. Even, you know, to the point at the end when he's like, please write a letter and address it to mom,
yeah.
right? Not mother. He's a
she
kid.
Says that she starts. She says, dear mother. Yeah. He goes, no, it's mom. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. He's a kid. So,
yeah.
So it can't be, you know, easy that he just shot somebody feet from him. So yeah, powerful.
For people not in the medicine, it's probably tough for us. I mean, us. I will say it is tough for me. Sometimes I think we kind of regard people in the medical field as like they're doctors or they're nurses first, and then they're sort of people second, which of course is not the case, obviously. But like, it's hard to reconcile Margaret being a nurse, and of course her main goal as a nurse is to care for people, and yet she feels no compunction about being happy that this Chinese soldier is dead, because she regards him as the enemy, something less than a person. And you can almost kind of be like, wow, doesn't that butt up against your sense of being a nurse? But as we realize, it's kind of like the same thing about like doctors that smoke. You know, you're like, how can you smoke? Don't you know that it's bad? Well, they're a person first and they're addicted to nicotine. And yeah, they're a doctor and they know better, but they're still doing it anyway. But it's always just, it's an interesting observation to give to Margaret that she feels kind of very little about this abstract idea that this person has been killed. She doesn't really kind of care.
Yeah. And, you know, like, as you've pointed out this whole season, right, she speaks Chinese. She feeds these children, right? There is this compassion in her this season that has come out, I would say, very much. This sounds almost like old Margaret. So maybe we're still sort of like in a little bit of a transition. You know, she could just be thinking like, well, you know, if it was either him or you, I'm glad that you're alive, right? But, and she is sitting there, right? He seems fine with a bandage on his shoulder. She is taking the time to hear his story, which I think is sort of that human touch. For the bit about like being a doctor first, there are times that you have to be like, okay, I have to put the screaming mother, right? I have to shut that out, right? It's all science now. It's all action. And now that things have calmed down, I can now go and have that bedside manner and have the discussion. But this isn't that sort of situation. This guy's already like better. So
yeah. It's a great piece, and it's a good performance by this actor Daniel Zippy, who I said just has some TV credits. I'm not really familiar with him beyond this episode. So then the next vignette is a little on the sillier side. It's Klinger. Dressed in this sort of almost like the cotillion outfit that he's got with pearls, the sort of like mini pearl hat sort of thing. And he talks to a patient named Robello, and he is played by an actor named Richard Beauchamp, who has credits on shows like Happy Days, Hill Street Blues, and a show called Zorro and Son. I'm completely unfamiliar with that show, but there was a show about Zorro and his son, I guess. I don't know what that is. But he's upset because he had apparently a very manly mustache and they had to remove it to bandage his face. And he obviously doesn't worry too much about the scar on his face or whatever wound he's got. He's just upset that he is missing the mustache. And he talks about that in his culture, it's like not having a mustache. He's like, you might as well be wearing a dress, which of course the Klinger is sort of deeply offensive. And, you know, when you realize compared to some of the other problems these people have, his is pretty minor, but he's acting like this is the end of the world. To the point where he literally pulls the sheet up under his nose because he's so ashamed of his now bare upper lip.
Yeah. And it's, you know, even Klinger says like, you know, you can just grow it back, right? You know, we're probably talking about like 3 weeks, right? And he doesn't want to hear it. And in very classic MASH, I had to look up who this person was. Klinger says, like, so you're not going to look like Gilbert Roland.
Gilbert Roland for a while, yes.
Right? You know, and I'm like, okay, IMDb, who's Gilbert Roland? Oh, a mustached actor from the 30s. Yep. Okay.
Very dynamic mustache. Like, you could, he was, I think he was mostly a silent actor. And so you could, you know, like, you could see why he was probably I'm familiar with him. I don't know if I've ever seen any of his movies, but I could, even then I knew who he was, and I knew that he had like a very dashing kind of mustache. Like, okay, there's the reference there. So then we move on to BJ, and he's talking to a soldier named Corden, played by an actor named Andrew Block. This is the first of two MASHes he would appear on. He had a long run on Days of Our Lives. He was on Barney Miller, and he was in a movie with Richard Dreyfuss called The Big Fix. And it's a nice tonal change because the one with Margaret is kind of like mid-tier serious. And then the one with Klinger is very silly. And then we get this one, which is deadly serious because this is a guy who sweeps for mines. And he talks about that they lay the mines out in a pattern so that they know how to pick them up when they're going back the other way. And he forgot that. And the landmine has gone off, and now he is... He's missing a leg, and he seems to be dealing with it pretty well, but you know, obviously it's about as a grievous wound as you can imagine that you can still survive from, that you're going to go home with just one leg. And it's, again, another solid performance by this actor.
Yeah. Interesting to me that it is, you know, you almost get the sense he says, "I forgot that we booby trap some," right? So he probably is, you know, I did this to myself, which I think adds, he does give a very stark performance with the reading of his lines, which I think does say how serious this is.
Yeah, he's very quiet. You know, the guy doesn't swing for the fences. Like, he's just he's like, "I woke up, I felt my leg." He's like, "Herb, you got a problem." You know, like very, very kind of purposefully monotone, which really kind of works well for the scene. So then we're back to something a little on the sillier side, where we see Burns's patient in a rare moment for Frank Burns. He seems to care about his patient, which is a nice change for Frank. Although I think he's mostly caring because the guy's not recovering as fast as he should be. And he asks Colonel Potter for help, and then Potter can't quite figure it out either. And then he says, "Oh," and he calls out for the nurse, and Burns immediately goes, "You're right. It's probably the nurse's fault." It's like so hopeless.
Yeah. Ridiculous. It's interesting to me, right? So basically this guy is unconscious and won't wake up. So, and if he's Frank's patient, he probably had surgery done. So that probably means he came in unconscious. Everybody said, "Oh, he's unconscious because he suffered whatever he injured," right? We'll operate on him. And then he's not waking up afterwards. So sort of a medical mystery, which we'll find out the answer to in a little bit.
Right. The nurse, Jennifer, gets a ever so slight comedy beat, because mostly her lines are just "yes, doctor, no, doctor," you know, that kind of thing. But then when Potter can't figure out what's wrong with him, he says something like, "Beats the wampum out of me." And Frank goes, "I think he's sick." And Potter and the nurse both give Burns this look of like, "You effing idiot." I mean, I expect that from Harry Morgan because he's the actor in the scene. But either that was the actress's choice or that was a director of like, "Yeah, you look at him too," of just this like, "Oh, for God's sakes, the guy, what's wrong with this guy?" So now we find Hawkeye and he's talking to a patient named Whitney. And Whitney is played by an actor named Jack Baker. I'm going to get to his credits in a moment because they're really quite interesting. But his big thing is that he was wounded in the rear end. And so he's got to lay on his stomach. And we see there's this kind of, I'm not sure what, do you know what that is over him? There's some sort of, it's like a, we see like a concave shape over his rear end. Like it's something, I don't know what it is. It's obviously more than bandages, but there's something that's like padding or something, because we could see it. It's like, you know, it's like almost right above to the top of his head. It's so padded. So I don't know whether that's, you know, he's got more like bandages back there or something to keep his rear end, I guess, I don't know, aerated. I don't know. I'm just guessing. I mean, it would be what that would.
I don't know specifically what it is. So first I was like, could he have like some sort of pressure dressing on it just to sort of like control the bleeding? But this seems fluffier. Then I was trying to say, like, could it just be like a canopy of something? They want his butt to be open to the air, but nobody wants to see him mooning everybody. Yeah. So they built some sort of contraption over it just to sort of like give him
the modesty thing.
Okay.
All right. As I mentioned, the actor is named Jack Baker. Now he had a pretty, a lot of kids credits. He was in a kid show called Wonderbug. He did a lot of voices, animation voices. He was a voice on Plastic Man, which means the second MASH in a row featuring an actor that had beard on Plastic Man. He was also in the movie Love at First Bite with George Hamilton, the vampire comedy. And then in the early 80s, Jack Baker moved into hardcore pornography. And I'm not going to read the 30-odd hardcore credits on his IMDb profile, except for one, which was called For Your Thighs Only, which is just that's just clever. I mean, I got to get him that. So I don't know if Mr. Baker is still acting, but obviously his career took an interesting turn at some point.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to say that he had a long career. I was waiting for you to say that his career was on the rise. But
I'm keeping it classy over here, Andrew.
You're trying to keep it. This is a kid. This is a family show. So
I do kind of want to see For Your Thighs Only, just as like, is it a Bond parody or is it just they just took the name? Because that's my favorite James Bond movie. So I'm like, I mean, I imagine the name Blofeld. It's right there. I mean,
yes.
So, okay. But anyway, let's have to go on and on about it. Because some of the titles are pretty explicit. But anyway, he has this nice conversation with Hawkeye where he talks about that he's embarrassed, that you know, his wound is in his butt. And Hawkeye finally says, you know, there's no reason to be embarrassed. And then he says, look, you know, you have a very endemic wound of this whole, you know, this whole war. This whole thing is one giant pain in the butt. And if anybody back home asks where you were hit and they make fun of you, you know, give them your Purple Heart and tell them where to pin it. And, you know, he makes the guy feel better because obviously I would imagine if you're a soldier, you know, you don't want to get wounded, but if you get wounded, you probably don't want to get wounded in the ass because it is, you know, it feels a little embarrassing.
Yeah. Especially if you go home, right? Like, oh, you're home from some bad injury and it's like half my cheek was blown off. Right. You know, it's just, it doesn't sound heroic.
No, so. I guess not. So then we're back to Frank's case. And again, they're still trying to figure out what's going on. Margaret comes over again, a great beat for Margaret. Margaret comes over and, she says, we have an emergency. And Burns goes, ask someone else. He's handling my patient first. And Margaret just looks at him for like a full beat and then goes back to Potter and goes back to talking. I just love that she's, okay. And then like, it's just like, yeah, all right, just shut up, Frank. But she doesn't need to say it. I just love that she just kind of gives him that like dismissive, like, all right, okay. You know, which is a lot of Frank Burns in this episode. So then they talk about this other patient and she says he's got internal bleeding. And she says, even if we get donors, it'll be too late. And then Potter says, we'll remove his spleen. That may start some clotting. What does that mean? I know what clotting is, but like you can remove a spleen and that, how does that work?
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought this up because I have to tell you that I've been trying to puzzle this out a little bit myself. Okay. So first of all, you know, the beginning scene where Hawkeye slams the phone down on the guy, he tells Potter that Turkish patient, it continues to bleed out. I've given him 30 units of blood. So that is
a complete oil change. He refers to,
right. He says a complete oil change times three, right? Because
wow.
10
oh,
units
right.
of
10,
blood
yes,
in,
that, yep.
is inside a body. And so I was sitting there before we hear this little beat at the beginning of the show and saying, okay, if there was a wound that was still actively bleeding, they would go back to the operating room, right? Mm-hmm. Like we've seen them do that before. We, you know, oh, there was a vessel that was still bleeding. We had to go in and sew it. So, and this is three times his whole blood volume. So where is this blood going? Is the question. And then they talk again about how he's still bleeding and he won't clot and maybe we'll do the splenectomy. So there are some autoimmune things that people can get where they destroy their own platelets. Your own platelets help you clot internally. And so if you don't have a high enough number of platelets, you bleed more easily. You can't, if you donate more platelets because your body is destroying platelets, if you donate more platelets, give him platelets, they'll just get destroyed as well. So In extreme cases, because these platelets that are being attacked get kind of destroyed in the spleen, you can remove the spleen
hopes
of like bypassing that filter. All of that said, I have no idea. So he's not clotting, but like, is he just like how is he oozing out that much blood? Like if you've sutured wounds, maybe they're going to ooze a little bit because, you know, your body isn't scabbing, right? You can only sew so much. But you would think that you could do, like, compression bandages or something like that externally. If it's internally, I don't know what it could be. I'm surprised they wouldn't go back in. So these two things are kind of are just interesting to me to try to figure out what his diagnosis is. And to explain that dramatic amount of blood that they've had to give him. And so here is where I'm going to pose to you my philosophical trolley question. If okay. you're ready.
All right. Okay. I think maybe. I don't know. We'll find out.
Okay. So, you know, there's this famous trolley question, right? Like, there are five people strapped to one set of tracks, and there's one strapped to another, and there's a trolley that's going to run over the five, but you can pull a switch and have it kill the one. What do you do, right?
Right.
And so I just want you to think, they're running low on blood. They have an endless amount of wounded coming in. They don't know the next time that the wounded is
coming
in. They've given this guy 30 units. Okay,
he's a blood hog, yeah.
Right, yeah. So 30 units into one guy. And now imagine if, like, you've run out of blood and somebody who has something like a femur fracture, right, that needs 2 units of blood, but you don't have it. And so that guy dies, and this guy got 30. So welcome to MASH medicine, I would suppose. Mm. At some point, do you say, we can't transfuse this guy anymore because we're low, right? Mm. And then, even worse, let's say you say, I'm not going to transfuse that guy, and he dies, and then you never get any more wounded, and then the blood remains unused, right? Mm. So the Schrodinger's cat, I suppose, of blood transfusions. But so just interesting medicine for me, like a splenectomy. We rarely do that these days. But I guess in a pinch, you got to do something. So,
okay. Cause I mean, I didn't know anything about what the spleen did involved with clotting. So the fact that Potter just says it, I was like, what, what's the connection? And B, can you just do that? Can you just remove an organ? But I mean, I guess when you're in an emergency like this, yes. You know, the answer is yes, you can do that.
Right. And if that's what they think is going on, if the spleen is consuming his clotting factors because of something that's going on, then maybe you can remove the spleen and see if that can help.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, now I know. So act two of the show starts with Moody getting bandaged. He's got a small wound on his hand, and he talks to Hawkeye about that he was in a bar and he got some unkind comments from some other presumably soldiers. He doesn't get into it exactly, but we can infer from the way he's talking that they were racist comments aimed at him. And then he got into a fight with these guys. And, you know, he talks about that he works to save these men, and yet he's treated like this by some of his fellow soldiers. And there's a line where he says, yeah, those guys kind of got the best of me, but they won't the next time because I have something that they do not have, self-respect. And it's a nice scene. It's a little after school special-ish, you know, a little like it's a little on the nose kind of thing, but it's a nice moment. And it's, you know, I think it's a probably valuable thing as a reminder that, you know, obviously that was all still stuff that soldiers that were not white had to deal with. They're in their uniforms and they're protecting their country in sort of theory here, the idea of defeating communism or whatever. But, you know, he's being treated like garbage by his fellow soldiers, and you would think they would be above that, but obviously people are not.
You know, the thing that got me about this scene is that, you know, I watched MASH as a kid. I told you that, right? That was 5:30 on Channel 12, right? I watched it. And as a kid, I just thought it was like they bullied him. I had no concept of the undercurrent that this was about race. And then he says a line at the beginning of this. He says, they asked me if I could tap dance,
which
I think is like, oh. Like, now I get it. Yeah. That has some racist overtones. As a kid, I thought they were like, he asked me if I could tap dance, like, you know, like, can you dance in the ring? Can you fight?
Oh, okay.
Right? So it's only now that I'm like, oh, I get it. Right. You know, this was about that. And then, of course, that ending scene where he's like, I just have self-respect, I guess, like, walk away. But you still think that he should tell these guys off in some sort of way, or other people should be, right?
Yeah.
But it did, you know, I suppose, like, MASH is MASH, right? This was the mid-70s. Good for them for even putting in this little scene.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and he said, and it's well performed by Hilly Hicks. So then we're in the OR. They're back. Potter and Margaret are back with this patient, and he starts thinking about Frank's patient, and he says something like, you know, there is no good reason why that boy should be unconscious. And then he says, wait a minute. You know, where he was found in a sleeping bag, and he says, and maybe he had company in there. And of course, Margaret is immediately assuming he means like a woman. And he says, no, I don't mean female company. And he says, this land is filled with poison, those poison ropes, referring to snakes. And he's and he asks Kelly, did any of them come off the meat wagon in their bare feet? And Kelly says, some of them did. And he says, check around the feet and ankles. If he finds a bite, give him some anti-venom pronto. And he realized that that's what it is, that the guy's just got a snake bite. And he's got his lights are dim low because of the snake bite. And, you know, I mean, man, you know, as bad, like it remind that as, what a tough climate, you know, bad enough to have to fight a war. And then you got to worry about a snake crawling into your sleeping bag and putting your lights dim. And that what makes that, I recall there was an image I saw a bunch of years ago back when the Iraq war was happening. And there was a guy, it was a U.S. soldier, and he was posing with this scorpion that I guess is native to Iraq, except the thing was like the size of a Ray Harryhausen puppet. I mean, he was holding it like this. It was this big. And you're like, what kind of, what, like, what land of monsters is this? It's like you have to fight in a war. And they have scorpions that look like the size of like a xenomorph from Aliens. I was just like, oh my God. So, I love that Potter just reasons it out. It's a great little piece of medical/detective work.
Yeah, I love that Margaret, because of course their relationship is growing this season, yep. is like, you know, oh, you're brilliant, right? She just, yeah. He's just so happy that he's figured it out. And, you know, I'll tell you, medicine sometimes is that way, right? What is the most common thing this could be? Okay, second most common thing, third most common thing. As you eliminate those things, then you're down to the bottom and you're like, well, you know, maybe it could be a snake bite, right? You know, but again, good for him, because you try to think about, like, this could have been infection. This could have been some sort of brain injury. They didn't have CAT scans back then, right? You either drilled into somebody's skull thinking that you were going to find something or not, right? You know? So good for him. Like, truly, way to puzzle things out.
Yeah, and then he ends, they button the scene with him saying, yeah, if I'm so brilliant, why did I just put a stitch in my glove?
Yeah.
Which is a nice way to get out of the scene that he's kind of not paying attention to what he's doing, and he puts a stitch in his own glove. So then we're back to post-op, and Frank is with another patient, and this one is played by an actor named Alan McCrae. The character's named Nesson. He appeared in all three of the Three Ninjas movies, so that's exciting for him. Plus TV credits like Wonder Woman and Three's Company. And this one, again, is more serious, and that this guy is talking to Burns, and he talks about that he doesn't want to go home because he doesn't, I mean, he's trying to kind of like bare his soul to Frank. And of course, Frank is not remotely interested, only talking about his wife and that there's a blight that he managed to get his name on. He wants to kind of like copyright that so he can become a famous doctor. And you know, this guy is trying to talk to Frank, and you know, again, he tried to bare his soul a little bit, talking about that he doesn't like the killing anymore. And you know, as usual, Frank has absolutely no interest at all. And the poor guy even says, you know, I've seen enough death, I want to go home. And Frank calls the guy a chicken, literally yeah. calls him a chicken. Again, Frank's awfulness as a doctor extends in every realm of doctoring. You know, he's a poor surgeon. He's a poor diagnostician, and he has a terrible bedside manner. So there is no area of doctoring that Frank is not just shitty at.
Yeah, it's crazy because the guy, you can tell he's struggling to get out what he says. And at the beginning, I think he says something like, you don't want to hear what I have to say, doc. And then Frank says, we're ordered to be compassionate. Like, if it wasn't an order, I probably wouldn't do this. And then, of course, Frank just talks about how difficult his life is. He's only getting cookies twice a month instead of more often than that, right? Which is just in such contrast to this other guy who finally, you can see, is like trying to shoo Frank away, like, okay, I'm tired now, doc. I guess I want to roll over. And Frank just keeps going. Frank is awful this whole season. And I've, you know, on prior episodes, you've talked about how he just had to leave. There's nowhere else to go, right? You know, I mean, he's just horrible.
Yeah, just a really terrible, terrible doctor. I hope you've never known anybody as bad as Frank Burns, Ange. I
can tell you that there have been a few people that have been that aren't warm. Okay. And so, but nobody,
they have skills in other areas, though.
Yes,
right?
You know? Yes.
That's sort of the thing on Winchester in the early seasons is that he's terrible at bad side. You know, he's a brilliant technical surgeon, but when he's dealing with patients face to face, he's almost hapless.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, yeah. Oh boy. So then BJ has another patient, this actor is Sal Vascuso, and of course his voice is very familiar because he is one of the PA announcers on MASH. He is one of the mystery announcers that we never see at the 477. But he is, like, during these seasons, he's the guy yelling, you know, attention all personnel, incoming wounded and stuff. So here they're giving him. This is his, I think this is his first of two. He does two. I can't remember whether this is his first one or his second one, but anyway, this is, you know, his chance to be on screen on MASH. And he tells BJ he doesn't want to go home because he is making a fortune and that he's got a Polaroid camera. He's charging, guys $5 for a photo. He buys a fifth of booze, and then he sells it up at the line for $12 a crack, and then 50 up at the line. And I love that BJ has that line. He goes, right neighborly of you. Yeah. And the guy doesn't get it at all. Like, he completely misses BJ's sarcasm, that it's like, you know, geez, dude, maybe not, you know, try and scam your fellow soldiers while they're, you know, risking their lives, you know, but he's completely oblivious.
Yeah, and at the very least, I'm glad. I thought for sure it was going to be the whole, like, you know, grenade pins or things like that. At least it was like mundane things.
Creature comforts,
but still horrible, right? Like, you think most people would love to go home. And here he is actually saying, like, tries to bribe BJ into saying, like, please let me stay. such a contrast to the last guy who's like, I've seen so much death, please let me go home, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So then we have a follow-up with Klinger and Ribello, and he has made Ribello a custom mustache made after Klinger's own hair. And as we've seen in numerous episodes, Jamie Farr, very hirsute guy, so he's got a lot of hair to match. And he makes this kind of Frito Bandito kind of mustache. It's like, it's so big that when the guy puts it on his back, like, he can – I don't know how he attaches it. I don't know what, you know, whether there's like spirit glue or something, but it's hanging off him, and he looks like he's right out of the Treasure of the Sierra Madre. I mean, it's the most cartoony mustache imaginable. It goes from his nostrils to basically right at the beginning of his teeth. It's so big.
Yeah, it's like, it looks like a boomerang. It's this massive thing, and you're so right. The first thing I saw it is like, this guy should say, like, we don't need no stinking badges, right? that's honestly what it felt like, so.
Yeah, but it's nice. Klinger does the guy a solid, you know, and it's really nice. So he appreciates that Klinger cared enough to do that for him. And, you know, that kind of gets into, like, and we know Klinger's a good guy, but also he's a sewer. He can make clothes. He makes his own outfits. So it's like, I mean, I wouldn't know how to make a mustache. If somebody shaved, well, I don't have any hair on my head, but if I did, I wouldn't be able to make a mustache out of it. How do I know how to do that? But somehow Klinger's able to, like, craft it. And obviously, but it took him a good bit of time to do it. So it's a very nice gesture on Klinger's behalf. He's a good corpsman. He's a solid corpsman.
Yeah, the guy says, you're okay. And then Klinger says, don't spread it around, right? He doesn't want everybody to know that he's okay. He wants people to think he's crazy. So I thought that was a nice way to end that scene.
Yeah, it's really nice. So then Margaret talks to another patient. And this is my favorite one of the episode. Him talking to this guy. This actor's name is Andy Romano. He plays a character named Justice. He had quite an extensive career, both in movies and television. He was on Hill Street Blues, Get Christy Love. He was in the movie Bleach Blanket Bingo, Under Siege 2, and Bugsy with Warren Beatty. So again, he's had really quite the nice career. This guy, he's a slightly older soldier. We see most everybody else has been in their 20s. He looks like he's at the very least in his mid-30s. And he is hitting on Margaret Heavy, and he wants to date her. And Margaret, in a, you know, kind of a charming way to entertain herself, she kind of, like, returns the flirting. I mean, she shoots him down, but he doesn't let that stop him. And, you know, she's like, you're wounded. And he goes, oh, I'm in better shape than I look. And she's like, aren't we all? And then she sits down, and he goes, look, why don't we go out? And then she says, what do you have in mind? Like, so she's actually, you know, kind of humoring him. And he knows that she's humoring him. It's really cute. And then she says, maybe, what do you want to do? Go dancing? He goes, oh, no, that's how I hurt my foot. You know? I love this side of Margaret. We didn't get to see enough of this. It's really charming. And then she talks about that, of course, you know, they're both married, or she's engaged and he's married. And she says, you know, Donald's a lieutenant colonel. And Justice's response is, Sharon's a CPA. Like, he's good. This guy's really funny. This Andy Romano guy, he really did a lot with the lines. And again, it's a really charming scene of Margaret. She's being a really, this is solid bedside manner, because again, the guy knows he's not going to get anywhere, but she's, you know, she's kind of entertaining him for like the 5 minutes it takes to do his vitals and do it and fill out the forms and stuff. It's really a sweet scene.
Yeah, I love that that he says, you know, has anybody ever told you how beautiful you are? And of course she says, do you know how many times I've heard that line? And then she says, I know I'm a 9 or something like that.
Yeah.
Right?
So and he goes, how'd you like to go for 10?
Yeah. Yeah. It is. This could be, you know, I don't know if they could ever do this scene these days, right?
No,
but I agree that he it's playful in a way that it didn't feel like he was being like really, really creepy, because I think he probably would respond differently.
Yeah, he's not being lecherous. He's you know, I mean, and the minute she walks away, he tries the next line on the next person he sees, which he thinks is a woman, but it's now Klinger in a nurse's outfit.
Yeah.
And then he delivers his, you know, how many times I've heard that line. So, I mean, he's just kind of a hound dog, and he's kind of almost doing it to just entertain himself. Again, which is very, very charming. So then Potter makes an announcement over the EPA that I know it hasn't been 48 hours and I hate to ask you all, but can everybody donate blood again? Now, Ange, let me ask you, what happens if you donate blood too soon? I mean, what literally, had you just faint? I mean, what can happen if you do that?
Yeah. Did you ever see the abominable Dr. Fibes?
Of course I did.
He drains that guy, right?
Well, so, that's not donating blood. Yeah. Though. Yeah. Drain that guy.
I know. So you could imagine, right? You take a pint of blood out of somebody.
Sure.
Your body is going to be like, you don't have enough blood. We have to make more blood. It's going to take you a little bit of time to sort of recover that, right? Mm-hmm. So if it's like, okay, I'm going to take out one unit, right? So now I'm going to take out 2 days later another unit, right? There's a chance that you could be anemic, and then you're fatigued. You can get dizzy easily, those sort of things. So you don't want to do that, right? You don't want everybody to be at a half tank, if we're going to borrow what Frank says, right?
So, Frank's awful metaphor. Yeah.
Anyway, and there's a reason why blood banks will say something like, the next time that you can donate with us is whatever, 6 weeks, 8 weeks from now, right? Because they want to make sure that you have time for your body to sort of like, you know, create more blood and sort of get it more back into circulation so that you have some to spare. Give away one pint, not a big deal. Give away 5 pints, right? Then you're probably going to feel like all of those things, lightheaded, tired, all of those things. Your heart's going to have to beat faster. There's less blood in your body to circulate, to bring oxygen to places, all of those things.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So, I mean, right. I mean, so if you donated too much, you would just probably most likely just pass out. Your body would just sort of shut down.
Or you'd be like, there's no way you could do 18 hours of surgery, right? Like, much more difficult for you to do that, because, like, you know, your body doesn't have enough blood in it to circulate, to bring oxygen and all those things.
Gotcha. Okay. So then we're out in the compound and we see there's a huge line to donate. And Frank is being dragged to donate by Hawkeye and BJ, and he's squealing like a little stuck pig. But and then he calms down when Margaret comes out, having rolled up with her sleeve, rolling it down, having just donated. And she's like, you know, Major Burns at the head of the line. And he's like, of course, you know, and he does this macho thing. And then she walks away. He tries to get away, and then they throw him in into the mess tent where Klinger is the one doing the blood. But then help arrives with a truck full of Turkish soldiers led by Sergeant Atias, played by the actor Zito Kazan, who just passed away last year. He had a career in TV and movies. He was in Waterworld, 13 Days, so both Kevin Costner movies. And then back-to-back, he did guest appearances on Traverjon MD and BJ and the Bear. So, you know, there he's again, BJ and the Bear, the official MASH spinoff that nobody talks about. But right there, he's got, you know, kind of another MASH connection. And he talks about that in gratitude for saving the life of our commander. I think he says commander, which is that guy who needed the 30 pints, which, again, we're seeing that this ended up working out. They are here to donate blood. And it's like 10 guys. And, of course, they're all jumping off the truck and everybody gives them a round of applause because they're, you know, that's going to really help. That's even more than 10 guys. It's like 12 or 14 guys. It's like a lot of guys filing out into the foreground. And just at that moment, as he's about to go into the mess tent, Frank runs out and Klinger's chasing him with a needle, doing his best Bela Lugosi voice, saying that it won't hurt at all. And Sergeant Atias says, well, you know, what's wrong with that guy? And he says, oh, he's one of our brave people right now. He wants his mommy. And then they let Sergeant Atias into, they lead him into the mess tent. And that's the end of our, basically the end of the show.
Yeah, I just have to say, I hope there's two more trucks of Turkish guys behind this one. Because even if it's 14 guys and they both give two units, that's 28 units of blood, right?
Not a ton, right.
It's not a ton. And then, of course, you have to cross-match the blood type. So who knows what blood type these guys are. So, but certainly, hooray for them for showing up. And I'm glad that they're doing this. In my mind, I always said, and again, only after medical school and those sort of things, like, I hope there's a bus to continue.
Maybe it gets them over the hump to tomorrow, you know, and finally enough comes in or whatever. So, and then we have our button scene, one more scene in the post-op with Colonel Potter talking to yet another guest star. This is an actor named Gary Springer playing a soldier named Garvin. He was in movies like Dog Day Afternoon, Jaws 2. He's one of the teens that's constantly being threatened of being eaten by the shark in Jaws 2. And he was in a really delightful little movie called Between the Lines, which is a kind of a unknown sort of movie, but it's I've seen it and it's really interesting, about like kind of an independent newspaper. So he's in that movie. And again, that's a little gem. If you ever can find that, I would say check it out. It's got an amazing cast, like young Jeff Goldblum, John Hurt, and a really amazing group of actors. But that this is a great scene where he mentions, the soldier mentions that he's from Chicago, and Potter is like, oh, well, this will get you excited. The do drop in. And the soldier kind of stares blankly. And he's like, you know, he's like the tavern on the corner of State and Dearborn. And the guy's like, Colonel, State and Dearborn don't meet. They run parallel, sir. And by the way, there's no bar there. And he's like, he's like, there's a bank. A bag, where they put that in around 1900. And we start realizing that Colonel Potter does not know Chicago the way he thinks thinks he does. And I actually looked up some of these landmarks. And from what I could tell, they're right. Like, they purposely wrote them wrong. Like, they're correct in that Potter is wrong about these things. Like, when the soldier says they run parallel, that's accurate. So somebody was from Chicago, I guess, and got them right. And it's a really charming scene of Potter just being constantly thwarted with all of his reminiscences about Chicago.
Yeah. For me, when I saw this, watching it to prepare for the show, this would fit into your, like, Adventures of Young Sherman Potter, right? Because he's I was stationed there. We drank a lot, right? So, like, no wonder his memory is foggy. He was probably bombed the whole time. And I would love to see a young Sherman Potter, like, in 1920 Chicago. That'd be crazy. That'd
be a great show. That would great be
great show.
Look, Disney owns MASH. They need content for Disney Plus. I don't want to see MASH redone, but I would totes watch a young Sherman Potter Chronicle show.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's IP that exists. They could do it. I would totally watch that show. So, and there's a great button, even to the button. The scene is called The Button. And then they even find a great way to get out of it where Potter says, have you ever been to Detroit? And he says, no, sir. He says, fine. We'll talk about that tomorrow. It's great. It's a great kind of low key episode. You know, they did some kind of expansive ones over the course of the season, but this is a great button, and I keep calling it a button, excuse me, bottle episode, and that it doesn't veer outside of the sets they already have built. It does feature an extensive number of guest stars, but it's probably a little bit easier to shoot because it's not terribly complicated. It's only using, we don't even see the swamp in this episode. There's a handful of episodes where you never even see the swamp. But this is one of them. So it's got some great medicine stuff in it. Great laughs. It's a really good episode.
Yeah, for me, when I watched it to prepare for this, I wondered if this was at some point in the writer's room, they just threw out a bunch of ideas. And these were the ones that they were like, we can't build a whole episode around this idea, but we could do a scene, right? Some guy hitting on Margaret, some guy that's black marketing, some guy that like lost his leg doing his job, right? Yep. Because it really kind of felt like rat-a-tat-tat, right? You know, the blood, the low blood is kind of like a bubbling theme underneath, but the rest of this is just these 2 or 3 minute vignettes that are all so well done. There's not a clunker amongst them.
It's almost a little vaudeville-y, as they're like almost like little sketches, you know? Like each scene has its beginning, middle, and end, except for the scene with Rebella, which is two scenes. Yes. Everything else is this soldier, done.
Yeah.
This soldier, done. This soldier, done. And you can almost imagine like the curtains coming and closing and then opening up again on yet another scene. So, it's a really, really, really terrific episode. So, Ann, did you have a favorite line or joke from this episode?
I have two things. The first is the poor guy that has the buttock injury, and he's like, where am I going to tell them I was shot? And Hawkeye says, tell them you were shot in Korea, right? That's a funny line and a good answer. That guy will use that for the rest of his life. But it's going to sound – it's such a stupid little thing. But in the beginning OR scene when they're all on each other's they're all like yelling at Frank, and Potter says, shut up. Hawkeye says, nurse, lower my mask, and then sticks his tongue out at Frank, which is just so juvenile. So juvenile. But I can tell you, you know, if they've been operating for 18 hours, like as somebody who, like, again, before medicine changed, like worked 36-hour shifts and sometimes worked 18-hour shifts. Like, even now, sometimes a 12-hour shift for me will become a 14-hour shift if I'm involved in something. You get a little punchy, right? You know?
Sure.
And so that just rang true. Right. You know, like let's get the nurse that's not scrubbed and pull down my mask. Right. You know, so that's actually the part that I laughed at the most.
I think, and I also like, I think he, when she does that, he goes, thank you. Like, yeah. That's a very dainty, yeah. You know.
Yeah. She pulls the mask back up, of course.
So. Yeah, that is terrific. My favorite line is actually, you sort of paraphrase it a little. It's the final scene with Colonel Potter is where he, you know, when he hits like the third example of misremembering something, and he just goes, well, I used to drink a lot in those days. Yeah. And he just kind of dismisses it of like, I've obviously drank enough that it is blotted out large chunks of my memory at this point.
Yeah.
And again, perfectly delivered by Harry Morgan. So it's a really, really funny line. So that's Post Op, everybody. And that is the penultimate episode of season 5. So Ange, thank you once again for coming back. You know, it would not be a season of MASHcast without you. So I'm so happy you got to come back for season 5. You absolutely will be back for season 6. In the meantime, tell people where they can find you out on the interwebs.
I run a Supergirl comic review site called Comic Box Commentary, and I'm active on Twitter at Dr. Ange 70, where I'll comment on old movies and comic books and MASH and things like that.
Very cool. All right, everybody. Of course, you can find back episodes of this show on our website, frontwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter at MASH477Cast. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Daniel Ulrich, Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Britt Schramm, Mike Thomas, Michael Porter, Joe Perino, Billy Shulman, Dennis Bailey, Kara Kay, and Tim English for their support of MASHcast. I really do appreciate it. So as I said, next week is the final episode of MASHcast season 5. Now I will preview this a little, and that normally the way I've been doing in the previous seasons is we end the season and then I take a couple of weeks off and I come back with a mailbag episode, kind of, you know, talking about ranking the episodes and doing reading the feedback that we've gotten over the course of the season, and then doing the official announcement for season 6 or whatever it is of the next season. But at the time that you are hearing this, I will be 2 weeks away from my wedding / honeymoon. So I'm kind of not going to have time to do a mailbag episode in the middle of all that. So I'm going to be doing the official announcement for season 6 next week, the final episode where we'll be covering the final episode of season 5. So wait for that announcement, but everybody, I will let you know, next week will be the official go sign for booking guests for season 6. I will be doing a mailbag episode at some point, but it'll be later, further into November, because like I said, we're going to be busy getting married, doing the honeymoon and all stuff like that. So get ready for season 6, everybody, with next week's episode, which again will be the for now, final episode of season 5. So that is going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
Colonel Potter? Colonel?
Why the ruckus, Major?
Sir, this man's unconscious.
Yeah, I can see that.
Well, he shouldn't be. He's my patient.
That's a good enough reason.